yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, we're going to switch back our show today and talk about the global economy once again. Lots of news there. That's very important. What's the biggest problem in the global economy? Is it the slowing of China growth? Well, the latest figures show that Chinese manufacturing, the core of that economy, has fallen for 8 consecutive months. And manufacturing now is totally stagnant, no growth at all in China manufacturing. So China's economy is slowing down. And talk is increasing that they're going to have to readjust their growth forecasts. Of course, if China slows, so does much of the rest of the world. Now, according to some indicators, China being the largest economy in the world. Well, it depends on what assumptions you make, but it's large enough and close enough that some are saying if you adjust for prices that China is as big as the U.S. So if China slows, which it clearly is, probably even slower than its official indications or indicators, then that portends problems for the rest of the global economy, including the U.S. So is China slowdown the big problem? What about Japan? Japan clearly has entered its fourth recession in the last 6 years. Over the last 6 months, Japanese growth GDP declined over 7% in the second quarter, and now another 1.9%. That's two consecutive quarters. That's a huge drop. And it doesn't look like things are going to change much. They're having elections there soon for replacing the existing government with the same government. No one's really challenging the same government, so we're going to get even more of the same out of Japan. What's more of the same? More quantitative easing. In other words, Bank of Japan pump even more money into the Japanese economy, which will stimulate the stock markets again in Japan that have been in deep trouble, given the last 6 months' indications. Well, is the problem then Japan? Nope. I wouldn't say it's Japan number one problem. I wouldn't even say it's China number one problem, serious problems. What about Europe? They've entered their third recession. Now it's Germany and France and Italy that are slowing down dramatically. And then there's this problem of Greece erupting again, as it looks like the Greek people have had enough, and this new party that has risen and in Greece is challenging for power. There will be elections. It may win the elections, and it's got the bondholders freaked out. And Greece is erupting again as a economic and now political issue. And we see the same thing in other parts of the periphery of Europe. You know, the rise of independent third parties here, which is possible in a parliamentary system, unlike the U.S., both left and right, people are looking for solutions. The center capitalist parties are not providing any solutions. As Europe enters its third recession in as many years. Oh, and you know, the Brits used to say recently, oh, well, we're an exception, you know, but their economy now is slowing once again. Very brief, short recovery once again in the UK that now looks like it's run its course as well. Okay, so is Europe number one problem? I wouldn't say Europe even, as serious as it is. And then on the periphery of Europe, we've got the Ukraine crisis, the worst-performing economy in the world now that the IMF has intervened, crashing, clearly in a depression, Greek-like depression of a few years ago, in fact, even worse than Greece, I would say. and desperation on the part of, well, maybe we'll talk a little bit more about the Ukrainian economy later, desperation on the part of the new Kiev politicians there. As you may know, they got a $17 billion loan from the IMF, and that's only made things worse. The IMF has taken over their economy, and it's collapsing. Okay, so is it the Ukraine and Russia? Ukraine is number one economic global problem? Serious implications for Russia and for Western Europe. But I would say not even that. What about the collapsing currencies of emerging markets? You know, Brazil, South Africa, all Argentina, Venezuela, Nigeria, all these emerging markets, economies that were doing so good, well, looks like their currencies are falling through the floor. We'll talk about what that means for the rest of the world and their emerging markets. How about the U.S.? You know, we hear a lot of hype going on now about the U.S., about all this growth, 3% growth, so on and so forth. Well, we'll talk about that in future sessions. I'm waiting to the end of the year and the holiday season to address that topic, but the data is not really indicative of the situation. You know, a lot of this growth has been the shale patch, shale gas, shale oil boomlet that we've had in recent years here. That now may be becoming to an end, however, and that will certainly be reflected in U.S. GDP in the fourth quarter. And then we have this serious problem that even though they're talking about all these jobs being created, now they're mostly part-time, temp, low-paid jobs. So you get millions of jobs being created, but you got wages still falling. How the heck do you do that? Well, there is an explanation for that. And they're saying, well, you know, this problem with the falling oil prices is going to really stimulate the U.S. economy. Holiday sales. Consumers now are going to save all the money that they would have paid in gas and spend it. Well, if that were true, why did the National Federation of Independent Businesses recently report that consumer retail sales are down 11% this year over the Thanksgiving holiday? 11%. Where's all the consumption coming from? Well, you know, maybe people are hurting so bad that they're pocketing some of the savings from the gas, and they're still not spending. Well, we'll talk about that. Well, the number one problem, you know, headline problem, coming out of left field, not expected here several months ago, but now really disrupting the global economy and soon the U.S. economy, is crashing global oil prices, global oil deflation. And we want to talk about that today. And I believe there is posted on the PRN website, my most recent article published for Telesur. Telesur is this media outlet in Latin America that's been put together by several countries in Latin America to get their view of what's happening in the world, economically and politically, out to Latin American public and the world public, not just the U.S. view. And Telesur has this agreement where, with a number of writers, they produce analyses and, you know, articles from North America, writers, on what's going on in North America and the world. Okay, so I write two or three articles a month for Telesur, and I believe one of those articles is on the PRN website called The Economic Consequences of Global Oil Deflation. You know, you're hearing this hype in the U.S. that, oh, falling oil prices are good. That means everybody's going to have much more income. In other words, consumers will save on prices, gas prices, and they'll spend it elsewhere. And businesses will have lower energy cost, and they'll spend the savings elsewhere. And that will stimulate the U.S. economy even more. Well, I'm going to take issue with that and explain why. Okay, so let's talk about global oil prices and the global oil deflation. If you look at what's happened to oil prices since June, the big collapse has come since June. Prior to that, oil prices were pretty stable. You know, in the $80 to $110 per barrel cost. And they had been stable at that range for quite some time. Now, all of a sudden, they're collapsing. Why is that? And what's the effect of that? And keep in mind, the collapse has been largely since, 5 months, 6 months, since June. Now, also keep in mind, almost exactly correlated with this has been a rise in the U.S. dollar since June. In other words, there's a strong relationship between falling global oil prices and rising value of the U.S. dollar. Now, the rising dollar is important because that's the transmission mechanism that causes the collapse of emerging market economies elsewhere. It's also the transmission mechanism that's going to ensure continued deflation in the Eurozone and ensure other negative economic effects elsewhere in the world. Okay? So, we have falling oil prices since June, and we have rising U.S. dollar value since June. Two, directly correlated. Okay, so let's move on. What do we mean by oil prices? Well, there's two benchmarks that are important to measure oil prices. One's called the high-grade North Sea Brent crude oil price. Brent crude oil. That's, you know, North Sea in Europe there, Norway, between Norway and Britain there. Big oil field. And that's high-grade crude oil. And it's the benchmark for prices. And then in the U.S., we have West Texas Intermediate crude. That's the benchmark that the U.S. uses. So if you look at those two benchmark prices, what we've seen is that oil has fallen more than 40% in benchmark prices since June. More than 40%. At the same time, the U.S. dollar, measured against an index of other currencies, has correspondingly risen significantly since June. Okay, so we have a fall in oil prices, which were around $110, $115 a barrel way back in January of this year, and stayed pretty stable, you know, to around $100, $105 a barrel in June, and now they've collapsed. How much have they collapsed? Well, they're down to, officially, around $60 a barrel. So we almost have a 50% collapse, really, more than 40%, close to 50%. The Brent North Sea is about $64, and at one point, West Texas crude fell to $59 a barrel. And nothing is in sight to slow that decline. It's going to continue to decline. Even OPEC, you know, Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, Saudi Arabia, you know, the Middle East, and also other OPEC members include other major oil exporters, Nigeria and Venezuela, so forth, recently met a couple of weeks ago, and they decided not to cut oil production, to let current levels of oil production continue, and that really sort of put the icing on the cake and sent the price falling even further now. And there's no indication that OPEC majors, Saudis, in other words, and others who are going to take action to try to reduce supply to raise the price of oil. So it's going to continue to fall. Even OPEC members admit that it's continuing to fall. And the prediction is, by OPEC members themselves, that it could fall to $50 a barrel. I believe that that is a minimum further decline. It could fall well into the $40 per barrel range here, which is what had happened to oil during the crash, the great global crash here in 2008-09. Oil fell to $40 a barrel. Well, it falls so far because in 2008, industry everywhere was shutting down. So not as much demand. A lot of people laid off. People weren't driving as much as well. So a lot of factors. The demand for oil collapsed, and therefore the price for oil collapsed to $40 a barrel. And that was $40 a barrel is an indication of a deep global contraction in the global economy, because oil is used for many, many things. So when it falls that low, it means that the demand for oil has collapsed. Therefore, the economy has collapsed. So if we're falling from $115 to now $60 and continuing, that really is an indication that the global economy is slowing rapidly. Demand is declining. At the same time, supply for oil is rising rapidly and will continue to rise. Like we said, OPEC and the Saudis will continue pumping out as much as they are. And we have the other big factor, which is U.S. Shale gas and oil production, now at record levels and continuing for now. And that has put a big pressure on the supply of global oil. You know, when they say shale gas fracking, which is occurring in the U.S. in a number of places, shale gas fracking also means oil, because when you frack, oftentimes you bring up the oil as much as you bring up the gas. So we've got this fracking going on and a huge increase in U.S. oil production. U.S. is becoming the world leader in oil production once again. And it's focused in certain parts of the country. You know, there's the Bakken oil field, shale oil field in North Dakota and Wyoming. There's the Eagle Ford in Texas. And, of course, we have oil production that goes on in Alaska. And we have the Marcellus shale fields in Pennsylvania. And if you look at those states, those are the states that are doing best economically, because of the industrial production of all that oil and gas going on. You know, it's the Southwest. Look at the states that have done the best in the economy. You know, it's Oklahoma, Texas, New Mexico, Louisiana, and North Dakota, Wyoming, Pennsylvania, and Alaska. Well, and U.S. GDP is heavily concentrated. The growth is heavily concentrated in those states. In other words, this economic growth that we've seen, the 3%, is not generalized throughout the U.S. It's geography-focused to a great extent. So what happens if that geography focus, shale oil production, comes to a halt? Well, it can only mean a decline in U.S. GDP, or a slowing in the growth of U.S. GDP, and that's coming. We're going to begin to see that reflected in the fourth quarter GDP. This 3 to 4% growth that we've had for the last 6 months is going to come to an end. And we're going to see a sharp reduction once again in GDP. And I'm not saying negative. I'm saying a sharp slowdown from 3% to something less than 2%. In other words, since the recovery in 2009, the U.S. growth has been, on average, about 1.7, 1.8%, which is about half of what it should be. It's not as bad, of course, as Europe or Japan, which has been negative, i.e. true recessions, but it's been well below the historic average of U.S. growth. This is not a real full recovery. All right. And we can see that lack of full recovery in the U.S. in what's happening to wages. Even though we're growing jobs, a lot of the jobs in those oil states, and, of course, a lot of jobs being created that are part-time, temp, low-pay service jobs everywhere. At the same time, we're losing full-time, permanent jobs. We're churning out full-time, permanent jobs at higher pay and replacing them with one and a half low-pay jobs. That's what business is doing. And it's doing it everywhere. It's not just in the U.S. This is what capitalists are doing everywhere. They're changing the nature of the labor markets, and they're hiring more and more part-time temp of various kinds, no benefits, low wages. And because we see people leaving full-time and having part-time temp jobs, and some leaving the labor force, you know, altogether, even though we're growing jobs, wages are falling. We have a decline in wages. In fact, 1% to 2% median family income decline going on every year. And that is probably a high-end estimate, because when you look at government statistics and wage growth, that's pretty stagnant. They're really looking at full-time permanent jobs, wage growth. They're not looking at part-time jobs or the millions of people who have left the labor force altogether. If they average that in, it would be even more wage decline, real wage decline, than we're talking about. Okay. Economists and business press and governments nonetheless are arguing in the advanced economies, you know, North America, Europe, and Japan, that, you know, there's a positive spin to these falling oil prices. It will mean lower costs to both businesses and consumers in the advanced economies. The assumption is now that those lower costs will mean income increases to both businesses and households, and the assumption is those businesses and households will then turn around and spend those savings. That's the big assumption. Now, the assumption is you're going to turn around and spend every penny of the lower gasoline prices. And businesses will spend every penny and invest it and expand their savings. I don't believe that's going to happen. I don't believe it is happening. I believe household spending decisions and business investing decisions have a number of determinant factors, and lower costs is not the only thing influencing those decisions. But that's what neoclassical economic theory argues, that you know, if you reduce wages, reduce interest rates, reduce you know, taxes for businesses, they will automatically turn around and spend it, and the economy will get a boost from it. No, they turn around, they hoard it. They hoard the savings, or they send it out of the country, or they invest in financial assets that don't create any jobs and any real economic activity. That's been happening on the business side. Well, what about on the consumer side? Lower gasoline prices, is that going to mean a boost to spending? Well, hasn't, according to the National Federation of Independent Businesses estimate, 11% decline, hasn't, you know, and these spending, you know, oil prices have been falling for 6 months now. You know, where's the real consumer effect? We don't see it. They keep saying it's coming. We don't see it. But even if it did come, even if, you know, the savings from the pump were respent by households somewhere else, that does not represent a net gain to GDP. We're just moving the money around. Instead of spending it on gas, we're going to spend it on something else. That's no net increase. That's just the shifting, you know, from one form of consumer goods, you know, to another form of consumer goods. Not a net gain. All right, well, we're not talking about that. You know, they're just talking about, well, somehow it gets translated into a net gain. Even if they spent every penny of the gasoline savings, you know, which I don't think is going to happen, I don't believe that this effect will be very significant on consumer spending, or certainly on business spending. All right. So the argument that falling gasoline and oil prices means a rising U.S. economy is not necessarily true. On the other hand, falling oil prices have a number of really negative effects on the U.S. and global economy. Let's talk about some of them. And if you want more detail, read the article on PRN here that I've submitted. Okay, so what are some of the potential major negative impacts of falling global oil prices? Right. Well, the first one that I think we already are seeing the effects is as I said at the outset here, a rise in the value of the U.S. dollar, which means a corresponding decline in the currencies of other economies, other emerging market economies, especially those economies that are dependent on commodity exports and oil as an export. Okay. A second major negative effect is that falling oil prices, oil makes and gas and related makes up a big part of the price indexes, consumer price index and so forth, and falling oil prices means that those indexes, inflation, declines even further. And already in Europe, we're looking at negative, flat to negative inflation. Right? And in Japan, the same thing, close to negative. You know, I think the consumer price index equivalent in Europe was only 0.2% growth. It's almost negative. And then in Japan, it's like 0.7% growth, almost negative. And both are moving in the direction of true deflation. Right? Not stagnant prices, but true deflation. Now, that's really important when you have true deflation, when prices start falling. It slows the economy significantly. Well, how does that happen? You would think, well, lower prices, you know, according to economic theory, people are going to have more money, real money, and they're going to go out and spend it. But that's an assumption that doesn't hold. People don't go out and spend it. They sit on it. Well, why do they sit on it? Because falling prices creates a deflationary expectation by consumers and businesses. What's that? That's the expectation that prices can continue to fall even further. So why should I go out and buy something at Macy's if I think the price is going to fall further? I'm going to wait until the price does fall further. But by waiting, that causes business to lower prices even more to attract customers, which means more deflation. And that becomes a vicious cycle. You know, you could have the opposite. You could have inflationary expectations, the opposite. That's what we had in the 1980s, where people thought prices were going to rise, so you better go out and buy now before they do rise, because they'll be higher tomorrow. But by going out and buying now, you actually do drive them up tomorrow. That's inflationary expectations. Well, you can have the opposite, deflationary expectations. And I think Europe and Japan are at that point right now. It could mean a slowing of even further consumption and therefore slowing of even prices and the economies there. They're right on the cusp of deflation, true deflation. Now, deflationary expectations affect business as well. In other words, if I'm a business, why should I produce more today with the expectation that 3-6 months from now I'm going to start selling what I produce more today when the prices 3 to 6 months from now may be less than they are today? If I can't be certain about what I'm going to sell my products for 3-6 months down the road and I expect prices may be less, I don't know how much, but less, well, then I'm going to hold off from expanding production today, now. Deflationary expectations affect business and investment just as they affect households and consumption. And global oil is a big component, major component, of these price indexes. And as global oil continues to contract, so will prices. And so will grow deflationary expectations, especially in those sectors of advanced economies, Europe and Japan, which are right on the edge now of deflation. Not so much in the U.S. You know, we're somewhere around 1.5%. But prices are slowly slipping in the U.S. as well. You see, this deflation, global deflation, is a global phenomenon of capitalism in this particular phase of the failed economic global recovery, or partial global recovery from the 2008-09-10 crash. Well, it's a main characteristic, the drift towards deflation and deflationary expectations. And oil decline in the last 6 months is really now feeding that, accelerating that whole tendency. So what will be likely the response as deflation emerges further in Europe and Japan? Well, according to policymakers, the way you deal with it is have the central bank pump more money into the economy, like the Federal Reserve has done, Bank of Japan has done. QE, we call that, right? Print the money, pump it into the economy, buy up the bad assets, losses of rich investors and bankers, shadow bankers. And what do they do with all that extra money that's provided for them at no cost by the central bank? Well, do they turn around and invest it in job-creating businesses? No. What they do is speculate with it mostly, or send it offshore, or send it into buying stocks and bonds, or paying use it to pay dividends, more dividends, and more stock buybacks. I mean, that's another characteristic. You see, we have this overlay now in the 21st century, this financialized global economy with all these liquid financial markets and big investors and corporations as investors, individual investors, you know, and shadow banks, equity funds, and hedge funds, and so forth. That's where they mostly play for certain reasons. It's more profitable. They can get in and out. It's more liquid than loaning to real mom-and-pop businesses that hire people. So pumping all the money into the economy means these folks turn around and reinvest in stock markets and foreign exchange markets and emerging fund markets and, you know, derivatives of all kind, which we don't know because none of it is public. And this is where all the money goes, and it creates bubbles, asset price bubbles. You know, these are financial assets, and asset price bubbles are the result. The U.S., the Federal Reserve Central Bank, has pumped, you know, $10 to $20 trillion into the economy, almost $5 trillion alone in QE and the other in zero interest rates. If you're a bank, you can go borrow money for nothing, essentially, from the Federal Reserve and other banks due to Federal Reserve policy. And then what are you going to do with it? Well, you turn around and, you know, loan it to hedge funds and loan it to equity firms, you know, they buy up other companies, and they all invest in the stock markets, and that's why stock market, you know, has gone through the roof, you know. It's tripled since the crash. The value of the Dow has tripled, you know. You know, the stock prices bounce up and down. I'll explain why that's happening. And why that volatility is increasing and will continue to increase. But, you know, that's where they make most of their financial asset profits. And they've been very lucrative in the last 4, 5, 6 years for investors. See, the capitalists are no longer doing their number one job for the capitalist economy, and that is to grow real assets, you know, real production, and to keep the economy going, global economy going and growing at a reasonable rate that continues to provide jobs and income for the growing population. They are no longer doing that historically. This is an important transition occurring in the 21st century. They would rather reinvest all that money that they create in financial assets. They've come to the conclusion it's more profitable to make money by creating money than it is to make money by creating goods and services. That's not to say that there is no goods and services production going on and increase. Yes, there is, but increasingly all the, you know, much of the money in the economy is going to financial investment and speculation. Okay, so to get back to Europe and Japan, what that means is that when deflation occurs, their central banks are going to pump even more money into it because they think that's what will stimulate real investment, but it won't. It'll just create more asset bubbles in Europe and Japan. Oh, so, you know, the rich folks that invest in bonds and in stocks will do well and continue to do well as they have been You know, we have this terrible statistic in the U.S. that 95% of all the income growth in the U.S. since 2009 has gone to the wealthiest 1%. Well, this 1% does not work. You know, their job is to figure out how they move their money around. They have been moving it around quite successfully. That's why they get 95% of all the income growth. And the rest of us get the other 5%. That's the fundamental reality of the post-recovery period in the U.S. The stock and bond markets and foreign exchange markets and derivative markets are all booming and continuing to boom, and those people do quite well. So we'll see more of that. The falling oil prices, to sum up, for Japan and Europe will mean more deflation, will mean those countries and regions will pump even more free money through QE and other tools into the global economy. It will give a further boost to the stock and bond markets, but it won't do anything for growing the rest of their economies. So they will continue to slide into deflation and recessions, in and out, in and out. Now, that has a big effect on the global economy, because that's a big part of the global economy, Japan and Europe. Right? And if those folks are in recession, they're not going to buy U.S. goods. So U.S. production of real goods and services, and therefore exports to those sectors of the global economy, will decline. And they are. And that will be exacerbated by the rising value of the U.S. dollar. So two effects will mean less production, less U.S. GDP for export. And you can trace this back to the falling global oil prices, through the effect on the economies in Europe and Japan, and indirectly through the effect on U.S. exports to these countries. All right, so there's a third important impact as well, and of falling global oil prices, and that is on the emerging market economies and on the drift towards more global financial instability and volatility. Okay, let's talk about that. What is oil, global oil deflation's potential impact on emerging markets? Well, the key mechanism is this relationship between falling oil and rising U.S. dollar. Because as oil falls in price into the $40 barrel range, the dollar rises, not only slowing the U.S. exports and U.S. economy, but really many times worse, exacerbating problems in the emerging market economies. Brazil, Chile, Argentina, South Africa, even Australia, which is not an emerging market, but very much like these countries that are dependent upon commodity production and sales to the rest of the developed world, to the AEs, advanced economies, Europe, North America, Japan, and to China. Okay. The falling currencies are a consequence of rising dollar currency values, which, as I said, is tied to the global oil glut. Global oil glut, rising dollar, falling emerging market currencies. Now, when the currencies of these other countries collapse, which they are now doing, right, it sets in motion a number of developments which have a really serious negative impact on the economies of those countries. Okay, what kind of impact? Well, think of it this way. If my currency, I'm a country, emerging market country, if my currency is declining, who wants to invest in my country? You know, what kind of foreign direct investment investors, who wants to bring investment capital to my country if, when they bring the capital, usually in the form of dollars or euros, and they exchange it for my currency is falling. They're going to take a loss just by converting their currency to my currency, which they have to do if they want to do business in my country. is going to collapse. The value of their investment automatically falls. So they don't want to do that. What it means is a decline in foreign direct investment into these emerging markets. Another negative effect is that, if my currency is falling, those who have already invested in my market economy, let's say Brazil, okay, if they've already invested, they want to get their money out. You know, if the value of my currency is falling, then the value of their investments already made is declining. So they want to sell those investments and convert them back to dollars and send the money back to the U.S. or put it in U.S. government bonds or put it in the U.S. stock market. Right? So they're going to dump my currency, dump their investments already made in my economy. And that causes my currency to fall even more because they're selling the value, selling my currency and converting to dollars. Well, you know, that's going to this declining demand for my currency, which means my currency is going to fall even more. So it's not just a rising dollar that causes my currency to fall. It's this movement of capital in and out of the country that causes the currency to fall even more. Now, it's exacerbated in those countries, emerging market economies, where they're largely dependent upon oil exports. And what countries are those? Well, if you look at Russia, right, heavily dependent on oil exports, their currency has collapsed more than 40%. It's not the European sanctions that are taking a toll on the Russian economy. It's collapsing oil prices. Venezuela, even more. Venezuela currency has declined, by 50% since June. All of this, these currency declines, right, by the way, are it really began to accelerate with June, with the collapse of oil prices, global oil prices, and the rise of the U.S. dollar also, you know, begins really in earnest in June. These collapsing currencies also occur, emerging markets, since June. All this is correlated. So the bolivar, which is the currency of Venezuela, has collapsed over 50%. The naira, Nigeria's currency, collapsed somewhere between 15 and 20%, especially in the last couple of months. And even Norway's currency, the krone, has fallen 17%. A developed country, but one heavily dependent on oil exports, declined 17%. Okay? So it all begins. We passed the threshold here back in June, and now people are just becoming aware of it, right? Now, oil is not just a physical commodity. It is also a financial asset. Ever since the globalization of trading in oil futures here a couple decades ago, it's become a financial asset. And as oil declines as a financial asset, so do the value of other commodities decline, which is a further pressure on emerging markets. You know, maybe Brazil, Argentina don't have that much oil to export, but they are heavily commodity exporters, and we have a decline in commodities all over, deflation in commodity prices all over. And that means money flows out of emerging markets because it's no longer profitable to increase production of commodities for export. The Bloomberg Index of 22 basic commodities has fallen to its lowest level since 2009. Okay. And, of course, the currencies of these emerging markets that are heavy in commodities, not oil, but general commodities, has also declined. You know, Brazil's currency has fallen by over 15%. Australia's dollar has fallen by over 12% in recent months. Right. So we have capital flight that follows this emerging market currency collapse, a decline in capital inflows into these economies. And where does all this money go alternatively? Well, they go into the U.S. stock market and bond markets. That's why, even though the world is slowing, U.S. financial markets have been doing quite well. And, of course, they go up and down, don't they? I mean, the U.S. stock market is 18,000 here, hit 18,000 recently, but then it collapsed again. And, you know, it falls maybe 3, 4, 5%. But then all this money on the sidelines coming out of the emerging markets rushes back, and out of Europe and Japan, by the way, rushes back into the market when there's a little dip, all these institutional buyers, and they drive the market back up. So we're seeing a lot of volatility in U.S. stocks. Between 18 and 17,000 on the Dow, up and down. The money flows in when it falls to about 17, you know, and it gets up to 18, they take their profits and down it goes again. Or when they see slowing global economy, it's an excuse to take their profits and down goes the stock market. And we see the same kind of movements going on in U.S. bonds. You know, strange thing, you know, supposedly the U.S. economy is growing, but government bonds are rising as well. They should be going in the opposite direction, but they're not. Well, that's because the money's flowing in and out of bond markets and stock markets in response to this, these flows reversing from the rest of the world back to the U.S. and even the other advanced economies like Europe and so forth, flowing back to the U.S. for higher returns, safer returns. Okay. Now, what happens when all this capital flows out of emerging markets, you know, and their currency is falling, emerging market governments try to reattract that capital, and they do that by raising their rates, their interest rates, their bond rates, to attract that money back in or prevent it from flowing out. Well, but by raising their interest rates, they slow their economies even more. Available money capital dries up, credit becomes scarce, and their economies slow even more. You see, we got layers on layers of effects here that cause these emerging markets to slow, and they will continue to slow down. So around the world, we have slowed on Japan, slowed on in Europe. China is slowing down because Japan and Europe in particular aren't buying as many Chinese goods as a result. And in fact, you know, even in the U.S., we can't afford to buy a lot of consumption goods anymore. And emerging markets that were booming and buying Chinese goods are no longer doing so either. So we have emerging market impact, serious impact from global oil price deflation going on, especially those oil exporting countries, you know, like Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, and so forth. Right? But in general, all of these emerging markets, you know, Brazil, South Africa, and so forth, are feeling the blow because commodity prices are following oil prices down as well, putting pressure, and then rising dollar puts further pressure. You know, all the talk about raising interest rates by the U.S. Federal Reserve is only going to exacerbate that. The Fed's been talking about that for a year now, and that has already caused stress and strain in emerging markets. But now we got this wild card of falling global oil prices that is another effect on top of the Fed talking about raising interest rates. You see, because it's raising interest rates that causes the dollar to rise. And that's really the transmission mechanism here that sets off these problems in emerging markets. Well, falling global oil prices have the same effect, causes the dollar to rise. So now we got the Fed plus Saudi Arabia and OPEC both taking action or threatening to take action, causing this great volatility in global currencies, which has these negative real effects on the emerging market economies, which then has a corresponding effect on slowing growth in China. And will eventually, here in the next several months, have an effect on slowing the U.S. economy as well. Now, there's another problem here, and that is falling global oil prices may set off another round of global financial instability. As I said, oil is a financial asset, not just a real asset. And if it declines too fast, too far, too fast, it will have an effect of spilling over to other financial assets, causing their decline as well. You know, these financial assets are linked to each other. And you can set off a chain-like effect. You know, we saw in 2007-08, for example, when we had the crash in mortgage bonds, and derivatives based on those bonds, it spilled over to the rest of the credit system and caused problems, generalized problems throughout the credit system. So, you know, mortgage bonds led the crash. We may have oil future contracts leading the crash here. Another problem is financially is if oil prices fall too far too fast, it will make shale gas and oil production unprofitable. And then we're almost at that point. In other words, shale gas in the U.S. at $50 to $60 is no longer profitable. We're already seeing drillers and exporters and transport companies and so forth beginning to shut down some of their shale production facilities in the U.S. Now, that's going to have, as I said, a negative effect on GDP and industrial production. But what it means is that these companies in the shale revolution still have the debts that they've had accrued borrowing from banks in order to carry out that increase in production, massive increase in production. They'll still have to pay those debts, but now they won't have the income flow to pay for it because the prices of shale will have to follow oil, and they're both declining, and they're not profitable, so they don't have the income stream. But you still have the debt that you took up in the previous period. You see, your real debt rises in value and cost when you have deflation. That's another big problem. Now, it's a fact. The junk bond market, the corporate junk bond market, over recent years has risen to huge levels, right? Overextended. It's been a bubble, junk bond bubble. And driving the junk bond bubble in the U.S. has been borrowing by the shale gas and oil producers. You know, maybe a fifth or a fourth of all the junk bonds written have been written borrowing by drillers and transport companies and so forth associated with the shale revolution. Now, they're going to have to pay those the high interest on those debts nonetheless, and they're not going to have the income to pay for them. So there's going to be defaults. Defaults are coming in the oil patch in the U.S. Defaults have the effect of a psychological spillover to other forms. You know, if you have junk bond, shale-related junk bond defaults emerging, it may drag down the entire junk bond, overextended junk bond sector in the U.S. In other words, the junk bond crash that may be coming may be very similar to the subprime mortgage crash that occurred in 2007-8-9. We may have created yet another subprime kind of problem here with junk bond debt in the U.S. driven by shale production now the falling global oil prices may set off a financial chain-like effect centered on the junk bond market. That's a possibility. I'm not saying that that's going to happen, but you see, these financial asset markets are psychologically related to each other. You know, when these rich investors see one of the financial markets crash, they know there's connections between all these financial markets, so they start dumping their financial assets. In other words, they want to get out first. Let the ones who get out later take the losses. They're going to get out first. And when they've made so much profit from the price increases on these financial assets in the previous period, there's a big incentive to jump ship real quick. Get out quick, keep your money, and let the others lose theirs as the price of these assets fall. So when you have a financial asset that falls, a key financial asset that falls too quick, too far, too fast, it can set off a chain reaction of investors dumping their other financial assets. We could see a chain reaction spreading from oil patch-related junk bond market sector in the U.S. to the general junk bond sector to corporate bonds in general. See, And that will mean, other financial assets will follow suit, particularly the stock market. The big contraction adjustment in the stock market has yet to occur. And we may see that emerge here. I'm not saying it's definitely going to happen, but we have the preconditions, the potential for that to happen. Because these financial asset markets have become overextended, you see. Stock market, bond market, junk bond market, etc. Overextended. Before it was real estate 6-7 years ago, but now it's the bond market. And look, the bond market is far more important than the stock markets. I mean, the bond markets are, 10 times larger and more important than stock markets. And if we have a problem in the bond markets, then you haven't seen anything yet. And that's a very real possibility. And it may be coming. It needs to be watched very, very closely. Right. Now, as I said earlier, we're having developments on top of developments here. You know, it's the oil, shale oil glut that's partly driving down the price. It's also overproduction. In OPEC, when the global economy is slowing, slowly but steadily slowing, the oil production has not been slowed. So the supply of oil from OPEC has continued. Why? Why are they doing this? No one in the OPEC countries wants to give up their market share. And this recent decision by OPEC and the Saudis is no one wants to be the first one to cut production back because they fear they'll lose that market share, you see, to their competitors, even in OPEC. So they continue producing. At the same time, shale gas has been and oil has been increased. So, at the same time, global demand for oil is slowing because the economies are slowing. So you have a perfect storm emerging here. Overproduction by OPEC and then U.S. shale gas production, overproduction, and slowing global economy. Both supply and demand are driving down the price, and there's no light at the end of that tunnel of that asset, global oil asset price decline. It all looks a little bit like, to me, use a historical parallel of what occurred previously. Now, history repeats itself, but never in the same way. In the 1980s in the U.S., we had an oil glut in the oil patch, as they said, in Texas and the Southwest. And that led to a crash of the economies. As oil prices declined dramatically in Texas and the Southwest. I was in Texas in the early 80s, and I saw it. And the regional banks that had financed that oil production in the early 80s in the Southwest went under. Just about all the major regional banks went under in Texas and the Southwest. And then, of course, the economies collapse in those regions as well, and the housing values collapse, and layoffs occurred, and so forth. We may be on the verge of the same thing happening, in North Dakota, Wyoming, and Texas, and Pennsylvania, if this oil shale thing really collapses here, which could happen, or certainly contracts, maybe much like the oil patch of the 1980s. And then we have another historical parallel, and that is in the 1990s, we had what was called the Asian meltdown. Currencies of Asian countries collapsed significantly, causing a global contraction in that part of the world. Well, the U.S. At that time was booming, however, because of the tech revolution, tech boom. And the U.S. Bailed out the banks, the U.S. banks that were holding a lot of these Asian currencies that were collapsing. And that was called the Asian meltdown. Big effects, of course, on oil prices as well, reverberated not just from the oil patch in the U.S., but to Mexico. And we had the tequila crisis, both the oil sector and the Mexican currency collapse in the 90s. So, you know, this falling currencies are happening now everywhere in emerging markets, not just in Asia, and it looks very much like an Asian meltdown. At the same time, we have the shale revolution in the U.S., and that looks like the oil patch of the 1980s. Anyway, history is repeating itself, it appears. And we need to watch this number one problem in the global economy, which is global oil deflation, which is going to have a net negative effect, not only on the rest of the world, but I believe will not stimulate the U.S. economy and could very well have a net negative effect on the U.S. economy in 2015 as well. Okay. Next week, we will keep our focus on the global economy, and we'll be talking more about Japan and Europe after their elections. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.